Good evening, everyone. Special welcome to all of our members and guests. Pleasure to be with this august group of teachers and leaders in our community for this special evening. Just a word of introduction in thinking about characters of Sarah Rivka and Rachel who we're reading about in these parshios. It's quite clear that the issues of fertility and infertility are as ancient as the Jewish family itself. These are topics that are always require great sensitivity. And the truth is that any time would be the right time to raise communal consciousness and awareness. But the science and the halacha have been evolving so rapidly that now is a particularly opportune time to discuss these issues. Every member of our community should know that in addition to emunah and tefillah, there are practical steps that they can take that may drastically change the way they conceive of their future. To help put these issues into context, we're honored to have with us tonight three extraordinary individuals. Morena Verabenu Rav Willig is known to virtually everyone in this room. He's the Rabbi Dr. Saul Roth, Professor of Talmud and Contemporary Halacha at the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, Yeshiva University. He's been a Rosh Yeshiva since 1973 and a Rosh Kollel at Reitz, and for the last 40 years, he's been the Rabbi of the Young Israel of Riverdale. I and dozens of my rabbinic colleagues call upon Rav Willig often, if not daily, to consult with on issues of complex halachic relevance. And Rav Willig is always not only exceptionally knowledgeable in all the areas, of course, that we ask him, but exceptionally accessible. Dr. Joshua Klein is a reproductive endocrinologist and fertility specialist. He earned his medical degree from Harvard Medical School and served as clinical instructor in obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive biology at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Klein has received numerous awards for his academic accomplishments in medical research. He was selected as a biomedical research fellow in the prestigious Darnell Laboratory at Rockefeller University here in New York City, and he has written numerous scientific research articles and book chapters in leading medical journals and textbooks. Finally, Rachel Tuckman is a licensed mental health counselor. She received her graduate degree in mental health counseling from Yeshiva University's Firkhoff Graduate School of Psychology. Private practice focuses on infertility and couples counseling. She also serves as a group therapy moderator for women experiencing secondary infertility. I'm going to ask Dr. Klein to give us the science that will help put things in context to begin. Then I'm going to ask Rav Willig for his remarks, and Rachel Tuckman will close, and we'll leave time for questions at the end.
Thanks a lot for the overly kind introduction. I guess we're recording. We can play back for my mom later in the evening, but so it's also a great pleasure and an honor to be presenting together with Rav Willig, and appreciate being up here together. And then also Rachel Tuckman is an unbelievable person that I know personally and professionally, and I'm sure we're all going to benefit from her thoughts. So thanks everyone for coming out. I'm an infertility doctor, so most of my day I spend trying to help figure out how to help couples have families. But the angle that we're going to spend a few minutes talking about tonight is kind of a really interesting, really challenging, really new intersection between the biology, which I certainly find fascinating, and also partly the social element, and also partly the Jewish and religious element. And so I think certainly there's a lot to talk about. I'll try to be brief and just set the stage or lay the groundwork a little bit about some of the medical side of where this whole conversation comes from. A lot of it is familiar to most people, but I think some of the more nuanced aspects of what reproductive aging means and how something like egg freezing might be something that is of benefit to young women is something that I will try to elaborate on in the next few minutes. So I made these little handouts, which they're just a few figures, and I think they serve as a little bit of a framework, so you can follow along. If you don't have them, you don't have to follow along. But the sort of starting point is that while in general human beings are programmed to procreate in young adult stages of their lives, both men and women, the specific challenges encountered as human beings age are a little bit different in terms of from the male and female side. I'm going to leave the male part of the conversation out for tonight. I think in general the issues tend to be a little bit less acute. I think that's a fair statement to make. I will say that I actually got an email recently from a member of an audience of a talk that I gave recently who pointed out that it's probably not fair and not accurate to completely leave out the idea that men are probably better off having children when they're younger rather than older as well. So I'll sort of put that blanket statement out there. We can elaborate on it later if you'd like. But obviously the focus for tonight is on the female side, so we'll deal with that more extensively. So the basic challenge for female reproductive aging is that the germ cells, which means the cells capable of reproduction, which are the eggs, are formulated or formed while a woman is in utero, in her mother's womb. And that same group of eggs is the same group of eggs that the woman has to use for the rest of her reproductive lifetime. And basically two things happen as women age. They have fewer eggs, so from a quantitative standpoint, they have less to work with. And also the percentage of those eggs, or the proportion of those eggs that are healthy, is gradually decreasing. It's the intersection of both of those points that sort of combine to make it increasingly difficult to both conceive, to get pregnant as a woman gets older, and also to conceive a healthy pregnancy. And the first figure on the bottom of the first page is sort of alluding to that. It's not really quantitative data in the sense that the way, if you see this sort of the x-axis is the age of the woman along the bottom, and then the y-axis is relative hazard of a first pregnancy, meaning likelihood of a first pregnancy. From age less than 20 until age 30 is exactly 1.0, which isn't really meaningful in a quantitative sense. What that means is that when you're young, it's generally considered pretty easy, and it stays pretty stable up to about age 30. And there's nothing magical about age 30 or age 35 or age 40. Certainly these are arbitrary cutoffs for the sake of conceptualizing. But I think it's fair to say that women in their 20s tend to be pretty fertile, at least when you look at things from the perspective of reproductive aging. And in a woman's 30s, that's when biologically things start to change and change increasingly rapidly. And the two curves that kind of come off of that inflection point in that first figure, one of them is pointing to pregnancy regardless of outcome, one of them pointing to pregnancy resulting in a healthy child, because not only does it get increasingly difficult to conceive, but also there's a significant portion of those conceptions which won't be healthy and won't end in a healthy healthy child, usually ending in miscarriage. And so it's that sort of double whammy that as a woman ages, she's facing a challenge potentially from both of those aspects that is really key. So now to kind of parse out those two things, I think it's important. So there's quantity and there's quality. The next figure is, I just pulled out a table from a study looking at a specific blood test, which in and of itself I don't want to spend much time focusing on. It's called anti-malarian hormone. Its acronym is AMH. It's probably the single best blood test if I want to get a sense of what is a woman's egg supply to answer that question. There are other ways to assess a woman's egg supply. And the important point here is that while generally it's true that if you take, for instance, 100 women who are 40 versus 100 women who are 30 versus 100 women who are 20, on average, the 40-year-olds will have fewer eggs than the 20-year-olds. And it's also true that if you take any individual woman and look at her egg supply when she's 40 versus 30 versus 20, her egg supply is going to be lower when she's 40 than when she's 20. But there are individual variations. So there is such a thing as a woman who has a robust egg supply even in her 40s. There are also, unfortunately, cases of women in their 20s who have a low egg supply. So there is this idea of customizing or individualizing what a woman's egg supply is like, and that's what things like this blood test AMH can do. And just to get a sense of the decline, so if you look at the first column, and I don't know how clearly you can see, it's pretty tiny, but the first column is age. It starts at 24 in this study and goes all the way down to age 50. Skip the second column, it just means how many women were included in the calculations. And then the third column is the median AMH level, which is, again, this blood test, that forget what it means exactly, but just as a representative number, women in their 20s, their egg supply is 3.4, 3.2, 3.2, 2.9, somewhere in that kind of category. When you get down to about age 30, you're at 2.4, so it hasn't changed a whole lot. It's less than it was when it was at age 24, but certainly a robust number. And then look at 35, you're at 1.3, and age 40, you're at 0.7, and age 45, you're at 0.3. So just as kind of one, I think, concrete example of what it means that a woman's egg supply diminishes meaningfully from around age 30-ish, up to her mid-40s. And by definition, a woman reaches menopause when she reaches the terminal end of her egg supply, which typically happens in around age 50 or 51 in the United States on average. So the first challenge, or the first aspect of the challenge, is egg quantity, running out of eggs from a quantitative perspective. And then the complementary challenge is the egg quality. What is the percentage of those eggs that are healthy? Because, for instance, a woman who is 40 years old, many women, in fact probably most women who are 40 years old, still have sufficient egg supply to be having a regular menstrual cycle, to be ovulating one egg per month. And a 25-year-old woman who ovulates one egg per month, in some way, if you look at it superficially, should be in similar footing to a 40-year-old who's ovulating one egg per month, because they're both getting one egg per month to work with. But this is where the quality side of things comes into play. So the likelihood of that one egg per month being healthy is dramatically different for a 40-year-old as opposed to a 25-year-old. So the figure on the bottom of this page is another sort of figure that I lifted out of a really good paper that was published in the Medical Journal in 2013. To give you about a 30-second backdrop. So a lot of what I do is in vitro fertilization, meaning taking eggs in the laboratory, fertilizing them, making embryos, and then using those embryos to replace them in a woman's body and help her conceive. There is a technology that is at this point now routine that we can use to do a specialized test of each individual embryo to see if there are genetic defects in that embryo. So the general concept is called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, PGD. Don't worry about that for now. But the reason I'm giving you that background is because this data, these numbers come from PGD data, meaning if you look, take, in this study, it was over 15,000 embryos. You take a lot of embryos that were made in the laboratory, you organize them by how old was the woman from whom this egg came from, and then you look at what is the likelihood of genetic normalcy or normality versus abnormality. So then look at the figure. The bottom, the x-axis is age, and the y-axis is percent of embryos which are aneuploid. Aneuploid means genetically abnormal, which is what we're sort of talking about in terms of egg quality. So ignore the 20s. There's this weird thing that happens biologically that women in their 20s actually have slightly more abnormal embryos than women in their late 20s and early 30s. So forget that part for now. But if you kind of take the baseline, in the late 20s, early 30s. So two things to note, I think. One is that you can just, without looking at the numbers, you can see that there's a dramatic rise. So a woman who is, let's say, age 30, if she makes embryos, we can expect that between 20 and 30% of them are going to be abnormal, or 70 and 80% of them normal. A woman who's age 42, that number is between 70 and 80% abnormal. So aspect, or point number one, is it's really a dramatic rise. And this is just the nature of the biology, and it's aging. We don't know the exact mechanisms of how time exerts these negative impact on the genetics, but we know that it happens. The second aspect, which is just for sort of completeness sake, is that even nature is sort of imperfect by its nature. So even in the sort of best age category, you're talking about a 20 to 30% abnormal rate, even for women in their 20s, let's say. So there's a lot of imperfection built into the system, but anyway, that's a little bit of a separate discussion, or a separate point of discussion. All right. So point number one is that it gets increasingly difficult to have children as you get older. Point number two is that phenomenon is exerted both through a quantitative effect and a qualitative effect. Point number three is that there is a common perception that modern medicine has the ability to treat infertility. And that's, I'm not sure I'd call it a misperception. It's at least a qualified perception. But the reason I put in figure number three is because this is data that comes from the national database of IVF. So there's a lot of different treatments that go into helping couples get pregnant if they're struggling to get pregnant. IVF is kind of one of the most, famous approaches. It's also the most invasive and the most successful approach. And what I want to point out here is that, once again, age is on the x-axis in this figure, and transfers resulting in live birth, basically just think of that as chance of success on the x-axis. There's two curves on this figure. One of them, the lighter line, is women using their own eggs. That means basically normal women who are, or just regular infertility patients who are trying to get pregnant. This data includes all kinds of people, people who where the husband has a low sperm count, people who have an anatomical defect, a blockage in their fallopian tubes, kind of all in, any kind of fertility treatment or any kind of fertility infertility diagnosis. If they do IVF, how likely is it that they will succeed? And perhaps surprising, perhaps not, depending on how familiar you are with this whole sort of little corner of the world, it all kind of equals out in the end when you do IVF. By far, like by an order of magnitude by far, age is the main predictor of the likelihood of success. So a young woman who has lots of other problems, fallopian tube problems, sperm problems, and or you know, all sorts of things, will still, on the whole, do overall quite well. And women in their 40s will still, on the whole, even if they have no identifiable problems, their chances are limited. And so that's the light line that you're seeing in terms of the likelihood of success stratified by age. And obviously, it's it's a discouraging at some level curve to see. Of course, we have, thank God, plenty of successes, and this is like just kind of almost overly superficial summary, but at least to send to try to elaborate the message here. The other thing to point out, however, is that if you look at the other dark line, that's for women who are using donor eggs. Now, donor eggs basically means that women who, or couples who, create embryos in the laboratory using an egg from some other woman. So to fertilize the egg from, let's say, the husband's sperm, create an embryo, and then that embryo can then be carried by that woman. So that's what we call donor egg IVF. Once again, a whole other conversation that I know Ravillig may or may not want to even like touch on, which we won't make him if he doesn't want to. But the point, however, is that what you can see is that if you're using donor egg, women who are in their 20s versus women who are almost 50 have essentially equivalent success rates. So the effect of reproductive aging is exerted almost exclusively through the egg. Or to say that differently, the capacity to carry a pregnancy in a successful way persists very stably, certainly to a woman's mid-40s, even late 40s, but the capacity to conceive of a healthy pregnancy using your own eggs, your own gametes, is obviously in significant decline starting in early 30s, mid-30s, somewhere around there. Okay, so that's the background as far as the science. And now I'll try to kind of spend just two more minutes and then, I guess, hand over the baton here. So this has all been known for a long time, maybe not all the subtleties, but certainly the general concept. And so it has certainly been a bit of a holy grail of reproductive biology to say, what can we do for women who, for whatever reason, aren't either physically able or socially in a position to have children to be able to preserve their fertility? And the long story short is nothing really worked very well. And still, what we have to offer has its obvious limitations, which we can discuss. But the bottom line is that nothing really worked almost at all until this concept of egg freezing came about. And really, in a nutshell, what egg freezing means is that we can do a procedure. It requires medication to get eggs to grow. It requires a procedure to remove those eggs. The medication is usually a daily injection or a twice daily injection for about 10 days, approximately. The procedure is a procedure done under anesthesia that takes about 5 to 10 minutes. It's not surgery in a sense that there's no like scar or stitches, but it's a needle procedure that's done under anesthesia with ultrasound guidance. So it's a real invasive procedure under anesthesia, but it's not major surgery. And then we can take the eggs out of the woman's body in any given month. Once we get those eggs, the technology exists to effectively cryopreserve them, meaning to freeze them. Once they are frozen, so from both aspects, the quantity aspect and quality aspect, those eggs are sort of literally frozen in time, meaning however many eggs we can get to be produced, which is part of the challenge here, but those 5 eggs or those 10 eggs, they're going to, when it comes to what is the health of those eggs, if we freeze them effectively, that's sort of held in place. An important sort of point to make there is that if a woman is 40 in her late 40s and freezes her eggs, it can be done, but the negative impact of age has already sort of been exerted on those eggs. So a woman who's in her late 40s freezing eggs, we may be able to, first of all, it might be difficult to get a good number of eggs, but even if we can, the challenge is that those eggs may, by and large, already be unhealthy. So the freezing doesn't improve the eggs, it can only sort of freeze things in place. Which, here the question becomes, and this is one of the sort of impossible answer questions, at what point, at what age does it make sense for women to freeze their eggs? Because at some level, obviously, the younger you do it, the more likely you'll get more of them and that they'll be healthy. So what you get for doing it is a lot more and a lot better if you do it younger. But obviously, on the other hand, you know, we're not going to go into the, you know, Stern College and push egg freezing because hopefully they don't need egg freezing. But on the other hand, if you wait till the situation is already a difficult situation, the product or the benefit of egg freezing is obviously going to be limited inherently by the aging process that's already occurred. So it's difficult, and there's no answer. But anyway, that's at least the background. So the next figure on the handout, and I guess I'm almost done here, is the reason I put that there is because egg freezing technology has evolved a lot in the last decade, and this is why you're hearing about it now more than ever, probably. You know, it was big in the news in the last couple of weeks because Apple and Facebook decided to make this one of the employee benefits for their employees, that they have some dollar amount that they'll pay for elective egg freezing. But basically, the technology wasn't very good until the last few years. Now it's quite good. Eggs survive around 90% of the time, so not every single egg will survive, but most of them will. And so there were enough studies that were published demonstrating the reliability of egg freezing in good hands that the governing body of fertility specialists in the United States, which is really the premier body in the world, came out with a statement at the very end of 2012 saying that we don't have to consider egg freezing as an experimental procedure anymore. Previous to that, if you were a doctor offering egg freezing, you were sort of obligated, if you're doing it by the books or by the book, to have your patient sign a research consent form that this is an experimental thing. Nowadays, we don't have to do that anymore by the rules. And it, you know, in and of itself, whether you sign the paper or not, obviously doesn't make all that much of a difference. But the point is that it was sort of a sea change in terms of the degree to which this is a technology that we think we can sort of rely upon. The last page, it would be a little ridiculous for me to kind of go up here and say this sounds fantastic, and not at least point out some of the things that are issues. And I don't want to get into the details. Maybe through questions we can get into details if you want to. But it is a medical procedure. It does involve medications, hormone injections. It does involve a procedure, as I mentioned before, and it's very expensive. And that's actually perhaps one of the key points here is that currently, in my practice, and I think this is representative of most academic fertility practices, the majority of patients who come in to talk about egg freezing are patients who we wish we would have seen a few years ago. One thing is that a few years ago the technology wasn't as good, so you can never sort of go backwards. But the other issue is that it's so expensive that it's difficult to imagine if you're 30 years old talking about kind of waking up one day and saying, you know, I'm a healthy person and, you know, I'm dating a good guy and so forth, but, or maybe not, but either way, that, you know, to come in and kind of spend $10,000 on a procedure to freeze your eggs is certainly kind of a challenging proposition. So currently the paradigm lends itself towards people who are already in a difficult situation who then feel pressed to kind of approach the subject. But certainly in an ideal world, it's something that wouldn't be only a reactionary decision, but rather a sort of proactive decision at some point to consider moving forward. So anyway, I'll leave it there for now, and obviously we can return more to it as we go along.
Thank you, Dr. Klein, for explaining everything. I'm just here to discuss some of the halachic aspects of egg freezing. Let me tell you how I got involved in this. As we just heard, it's a fairly recent successful medical procedure. It was spoken of as experimental for a number of years beforehand. But even at that stage, when the results started getting better percentage-wise, I was approached by a rabbi in Eretz Yisrael, his name is Rabbi Burstein from Machon Pua. Some of you may have heard of Machon Pua, a very, very wonderful group. I've been involved with them in various ways for many, many years. He says to me, you know, I think you should get on the bandwagon in terms of supporting egg freezing when appropriate. I said, okay. Rabbi Burstein is a very inspired leader, and I'm happy to follow his lead, but I asked him, what's up? Why are you supporting this particular initiative? He said, well, I have to tell you that there are women who are getting older, single, and if we're not going to allow egg freezing, they're going to do things which are halakhically much more problematic. I said, well, what do you have in mind? So he said, well, you see, there are women who, because they've almost given up on producing children with a husband in a normal fashion,
have taken to various procedures which are, in his view, and I share it, not in accordance with halachic standards. And this includes, for example, women who, because their fertility is declining, decide to have a child without a husband. This may sound as something quite radical. Perhaps in the outside world, it's not radical at all. Maybe in the non-Torah world, there are people having children without husbands all the time. They have a boyfriend and they produce a child. And what's the problem? We're talking about people who are either, because of their desperation, going to violate laws of prohibited unions in order to produce a child, or, in a somewhat better scenario, decide to be inseminated artificially and thereby produce a child. It's called, and you'll correct me if my Russian tale, if my acronyms are wrong, it's called AID, artificial insemination from a donor, and the donor can be anyone. Yeah, generally, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, they're anonymous, the donors, as a general rule, and you can go to a sperm bank and take your pick. It won't give you a name. It'll give you your hair color, eye color, of course, race, religion, height, weight, you name it. It's all there. And, you know, smorgasbord of opportunities for every woman to choose from. And by bursting, witnessing this firsthand in the Holy Land, and I've witnessed it here as well, it's extraordinarily pained and exercised by this phenomenon. And therefore, he says, we should rather, for those women who are, let's say, in their mid-30s and still single, we should propose, if they're interested, an alternative, which is freezing eggs. Freezing eggs means, very simple, you would never consider having a child without marriage. You are completely in accordance with the Torah's view of children as being part of marriage. But at the same time, you're very hopeful to find that Mr. Right. If you find him too late, unfortunately, you will not be able to have children of your own yet. I mean, IVF from donor eggs, that's perfect. But people want their own children from their own genetic material. So, I was persuaded by Rabbi Bernstein's argument. That's why I'm here. I'm just giving you the history. I'm here because I believe that for those women who view it as appropriate, this such a idea of egg freezing is something which is a halakhically acceptable alternative. I understand very well, as the good doctor explained before me, that the precise age at which this should be suggested is very, very subjective. You know, if you want to do it when you're, you know, when you're 100%, or so you look at the chart's right in front of you. It's at 30 would be better. At 35 is not as good. 40 is even harder. But it's important that I'm here to say it straight up. I believe it's a halakhically acceptable procedure, notwithstanding some minimal risk that was described in the last page, because although a woman, technically speaking, is not even obligated in the midst of a pure rule of procreation, that's somewhat ironic, but perhaps the reason she's not obligated, if one looks in the Sefer Meshech Chochma and the Parshas Noach, is because no need for any commandments. She has a very visceral, natural need to have a child. We need only look in the upcoming weeks, reference made by the doctor to our matriarchs. Soon we're going to read about Rachel Imenu, who said, Hava li banim v'im ayin mesa anochi. Give me children, if not I'm dead. Now of course the irony is she died in childbirth. That's for those who just look a little bit at the Tanakh. But it's interesting, what was Yaakov Avinu's response? No, any Balkores? Hasachas Elokim Anochi Hashem Onami Mech Pribotan. Am I in place of God who has prevented from you from having children? And Chazal are extraordinarily critical of Yaakov Avinu. Chazal and the Medrash Rabbah say, Kach Onim, this is how you respond. Elha, in the two versions, mu'akos, mu'aka, you know, we call akka, or we call narabish, we say it in davening every week. Those who are in a tight spot. This woman's in a tight spot. And that's how you respond? Kach, right? This is found, these four words from this medrash are found at Rabbi Burstein's desk in his office in Machon Pura and Givat Shaul Yerushalayim. Because you can well understand when people come and they're desperate and they cry and they probably yell and they, whatever inappropriate statements they come out with, and he's going to, after a while, at the end of his rope, and he looks at the little thing on his desk. Kach onim esamu akos. This is how you answer women in distress. I want to tell you something, that the original text of the Medrash is Kach onim esameikos. Those who unfairly yell at you. It's a better text. Say, not only are we not permitted to speak crossly or harshly, insensitively, to individuals who are themselves in pain from infertility, but it's even true of mi'ikos, of people who come and speak to us inappropriately. We dare not respond in kind. So that, you'll see in the Medrash, two different texts. Yes, Rabbi Burstein has the mu'akos, which I guess in Israel is more correct, you know, grammatically. I like mi'ikos. But even if they speak to you inappropriately, you still not you may not respond in kind. It's on his desk, and I don't have a desk of that tape, it's that type, it's not my specialty, but they'll believe me with many of these cases, and they're very, very painful. And that's why, although this is not the topic for today, but I do believe it's appropriate and even mandatory for me as a Rav to say, to echo what the doctor just said, which is that the single most critical variable in measuring fertility is the age of the mother. That's what you said. Now, if a mother is, forgive me, if a woman is unmarried, we have to do whatever we can. Egg freezing, may I say it? Shiduchim, we try very hard to make couples in order to make children. Now that's such an important, critical point. As a matter of fact, we are taught that one of the first questions we're asked in heaven is Osakta b'piriyah v'riviyah, that you involve yourself in procreation. And there are many who understand it to mean not merely that you have a child, but were you involved in helping others? The good doctor will be able to answer that in the affirmative for sure.
It was.
But what about the rest of us? So we're not in the lab, but if we make shidduchim, if we're able to put couples together, that's an asik. We're helping out in increasing pruru in the world. And I think that's very, very important. But I'm here to make a comment that a couple that's privileged to be married should not be procrastinating in the fulfillment of the mitzvah for Uruvu. I say it strongly and clearly and loudly wherever I go. A couple gets married at any age, 20, 30, doesn't matter to me. I believe they are duty-bound by the halacha to immediately attempt to have a child. The sole exception being health considerations. The mother's not healthy, whether it be physically or whether it be even mentally, of this nature, or other very rare exceptions. By and large, I'm a firm believer they should have children right away. However, they should be blessed, as we saw in the statistics. Not everyone who attempts to have children at age 20 has children right away. There's a failure rate. We all know it. And the complexity of what we call orthodox infertility, through the laws of Taras and Mishpacha, ups the number somewhat. Yes, there are treatments. Now, sometimes it goes to an extreme, and I want to put some balance over here. In some circles, they don't have a child in 3 to 6 months, they're already running to doctors and going crazy. But that's also the other extreme. But on the other hand, if a couple's married for a year, and they were living together normally, and the cycles seem to be normal, and they don't understand unexplained, I say, after 1 year, get a workup. I'm not discussing invasive. Just find out the basics. It could be something very basic wrong that should be corrected, either in the man or the woman, in a flash, and it could be wonderful. Too often, couples procrastinate. Number one, it almost invariably reduces family size. And we are believers in large families. We believe in it always. It's always been a priority based on the Gemaras and the Masechet Yevamos and elsewhere. We certainly believe in it today. We're still living in a post-Holocaust world. And since I'm here in the Jewish Center, Rabbi Lam Shalita wrote about this many years ago when ZPG became fashionable. You know what that stands for? No one even knows what it is. I'm sure you know what it is.
Zero population growth.
Thank you. Zero population growth, became a very big popular in the liberal community. We're screaming in our community against it. We were decimated. We have to make up for it. So it's very important that we emphasize this this idea. I've been asked, why am I such a strong opponent of women who are single, having children of their own, through what we call AID? After all, isn't there a responsum from the ultimate halachic authority of the previous generation of Moshe Feinstein, which allows AID in a circumstance in which a woman is married, but her husband unfortunately is not able to father a child? There's a very famous decision, in some circles infamous. There were certain Hasidim who took strong exception to this decision, based upon what their Rebbe said. The Satmar Rebbe was very much opposed to it. But they took it to an extreme, and we won't go into some of the things that went on here in this borough a couple of generations ago. This is not very, whatever happened. Yes, I'm a believer in this. I accept the Satmar Rebbe Moshe Feinstein. So it's crazy. If the woman is married, and according to the Satmar Rebbe, this enterprise is adultery, and if there would be a Jewish daughter, the child is stigmatized, potentially with mamzeris, the worst possible stigma, and still, I'm a liberal rabbi and I allow it, how much more so in a case where a woman is single, with no such stigma exists because she's not married? It can't be illicit. I mean, how can I be so opposed? And the answer is very simple. From the halachic perspective, the mitzvah pruvu is in the context of marriage. Just look on the Rambam. He tells us that a man who gets married is required to get married to produce children. That's the first line of Shulchan Aruch Ebenezer. And then he's required to live with his wife normally in order to have children. So the entire mitzvah is couched in the context of marriage. No marriage, no children. You know, I quoted the Rashi that we read just a few weeks ago on the famous pasuk of V'davak v'ishto v'hoyu l'bosar echad. A man will leave his parents' home and cleave to his wife and become one flesh. Rashi explains one flesh meaning the child that's born to them, who has the characteristics of both. So therefore the rabbis are teaching us, based on the pasuk and chumash, that yes, you leave your parents, you get married, you have a child, but not without that. And that's why I'm strongly opposed to this phenomenon, which I know it exists. And if a child is born, it's certainly a Jewish child. And I was asked, do you give this child a bris? I said, of course, there's no question. This child has to have a bris because it's a Jewish child. But then I respond, and forgive me if I hope I don't hurt anyone's feelings, but I feel how I have to express my opposition. I said, we don't have to make the bris with stuffed bears and choo-choo trains. Because we have these, you know, it's the latest style. Well, we should go to the person's house and do a bris, because it's a halachic requirement. I'm not in favor of celebrating births of children out of wedlock, even if the strict halacha is adhered to. It's not coming through illicit union, but simply from an artificial insemination. I'm opposed. And that's why, because of my opposition, which again, I'm echoing the point opinion of Rabbi Feuerstein from Yerushalayim, leads me to encourage, for those who want, this idea of egg freezing. Egg freezing means, if there'll be a husband, hopefully there'll be a much better chance of a child. You know, many, many years ago, we had this egg freezing is fairly recent, but sperm preservation is ancient. I don't know how ancient, but the sperm banks existed already 40 years ago, at least, maybe even 100 years ago. I don't know when it started. And I believe here too. Although generally speaking, there's no need for the man to preserve his sperm because, again, the doctor skipped over it, but you should see from what's going on in the world that a man can have children at a much older age without a problem, but there is a slight drop off. But what happens if there's cancer treatments? Shem Yishmael Birachim. No one should ever have to be faced with such a terrible challenge. My view is, there must be sperm preservation before these treatments. If the couple is married, absolutely. Now they can even have what they call embryo freezing, which is a much older technology than egg freezing. And I paskin, I had the psak many years ago, very early in my rabbinic career, that if a young man who's single is going through cancer treatments, it's still appropriate to preserve sperm in the hope that he will recover, marry, and be able to use his sperm to have children, because very likely, I'm not here to go into detail, very likely, after some of these very powerful treatments, his sperm is shot. It doesn't work. There's an unfortunate case where the psak was given, and the patient didn't survive. And I told the father to just dispose of it. There could be cases where a woman has certain cancers, and they're requiring certain treatments. She's a married woman. And I say right away, before you turn around, you'll do the IVF right now. She's married, so you have embryo freezing. But you never know what's going to be down the road. It may be impossible later on. So I'm a believer, certainly in the permissibility, and for married couples, advisability of these artificial reproductive techniques in order to enhance the chances of having children. In the case of single individuals, it's a different story, and that's why I'm here to support this idea of egg freezing, because some of the alternatives are much more halakhically problematic. Thank you very much.
Okay, so I'm here to present a little bit of the psychological piece. Sure, let me know. I have like a projecting issue, so just let you, I won't be insulted if you keep yelling at me to yell. Right, yes. Okay. I'm just kidding. Thank you. Okay, so I want to start by saying that I'm glad that everybody's here. I feel like this is a huge part of preventative measures, because I feel like in our society today, in Hollywood, we see all these stars, 45, 47 years old, Halle Berry, Jennifer Lopez, whoever, having children at 45, and they phrase it as, oh, I was so surprised I found out I was pregnant at 45, twins, a boy and a girl, who knew? And in reality, when you speak with medical professionals, you'll see that the chances of that happening at their ages are so small that you know that they're probably not being honest, right? And in Hollywood, I think it's interesting that they're so open about their addiction problems and whatever, and their divorces, but when it comes to infertility, there's still so much shame around that, and they don't talk about it, and that only permeates and kind of continues that whole idea of infertility being shameful and a secret and something, there's a defect in you and we shouldn't talk about it. So that's why when people are open about it, in Hollywood specifically, it does bring awareness. Right, and it does normalize it a little bit. People are more willing to talk about it. So I do want to let everyone know that Mariah Carey probably did not have her children naturally. Okay, so that's the first thing. And again, it's all that secrecy only causes more pain to women, right? Because she's 45 and she's having twins and I'm 30 and I can't have kids. Like, what's wrong with me? There's nothing wrong with you. She's just not telling you the whole story. So that's something important to remember, that that's not reality and that's not something to look to as our guide of what, a woman's reproductive health is. I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the things that you go through when you're going through infertility treatment, or through fertility treatment and going through infertility. And when you are considering something like egg freezing, whether it's because you're going through treatments for a terminal illness like cancer or because you're not yet married and you're thinking about it, it can be an emotional roller coaster, not only because you're taking lots of medications that can make you crazy, but also because it's a scary process. It's a very humbling process, but it's also a very scary process. So for anyone who's going through infertility, you feel lonely. That's the first word that describes it. It's a lonely road. You see that your friends are married and having kids, and you are either married or not married and not having kids. So that's a very lonely place to be. And a lot of the time when you're in that place, it feels like it's coming so easily to everyone. And again, that comes from the fact that people don't talk about it. Nobody walks around with a sign, "I struggled for 2 years. I had IVF." Nobody talks about it, which is understandable, right? Because a lot of the whole idea of having children is wrapped in physical intimacy, and it's not something we talk about. But it's kind of like a double-edged sword. Like, we should talk about it, but it's also that whole private area of your life, so it's how much do you tell, right? So it's very lonely. It's also, you feel very exposed when you're going through treatment, when you're doing the egg freezing process, or any kinds of fertility treatment. Everyone gives you advice, right? Especially if you're single, oh, you're 34, maybe you should think about egg freezing. I just went to this great talk with Rabbi Willig and Dr. Klein, maybe you should think about it. Everybody has advice for you, right? And that, it comes from a good place, right, most of the time. And we have to remember that, but it also makes you feel worse about your situation. People ask for details of your treatment. Oh, did you do that egg freezing? How was it? How many did you get? Nobody's business. And you can say, you know, I'd rather not talk about it. Thanks for your concern. Just going to keep it to myself. Don't be ashamed to advocate for yourself and say that you don't feel like you want to share this aspect of your life. Your life is on hold, right? So if you are going through treatments and you feel like maybe you're going to be pregnant, you don't want to take that trip. You don't want to commit to that business venture that they offered you. You don't want to do certain things. You don't want to run that marathon because what if I'm pregnant? What if I'm pregnant? But you can't do that. You have to live your life. You have to do the things that you would be doing if child planning was not in your future. Just like move on, keep going. And then if things come up that, you know, you end up having a child, getting pregnant, having a child, getting married, and then getting pregnant, fantastic, you change your plans. But don't put your life on hold because of what if, what may be, right? Because then we end up having a lot of regrets, things that we didn't do that we should have done. We feel invaded when you're in fertility treatments. There's a lot of needles and poking and monitoring, blood tests and ultrasounds, and it's very... It can feel like a lot sometimes. Sometimes you feel like you just don't want to be touched anymore. I don't want to see anyone. I don't want anyone poking me. I don't want anyone taking my blood and telling me numbers. I don't want to hear it anymore. It's a very sensitive time. And you have to set boundaries, right? You have to tell yourself, you know what? I feel like I've done this many cycles. I don't want to do anymore. Or after this many cycles, I'm not going to do anymore. Put up barriers for yourself to keep yourself sane, because you could really go insane in this process. It's awkward, right? You see people that you know sometimes at these clinics, or especially for males who are maybe doing, if they're freezing sperm or if they're doing a semen analysis, and they come out of that room and they see, hey, what are you doing here? Super awkward. It's uncomfortable. It's just, it doesn't feel good. And everybody knows why you're there, you know? So that can be uncomfortable. And it makes you feel even worse about your situation, because you feel you have to be embarrassed at certain times, and it's just not good for your self-esteem. Angry and jealous, right? And they say that unfair is the password to the infertility club. It's not fair. Why does she have a kid? Why does he have a kid? She's like the worst mother in the world, and she has 15 kids, and I have none, right? It's not fair, and we just have to accept that, but we can also express it. You can also feel angry. You could feel like it's not fair. There's nothing wrong with that. It's not. It's not fair. Stressed, right? So there's no actual proof that stress causes infertility. It's definitely not good for if you're trying to conceive, but it's okay to be stressed. Don't stress about being stressed. Despair, hope and despair, right? They cycle. When you're in your cycle, you feel like, oh my gosh, this is going to work. This is going to be great. And then you get that call, oh, it's a negative pregnancy test, or if you're freezing the eggs, you know, oh, I'm going to get so many eggs, it's going to be great, I'm going to freeze them. And you get that call, we couldn't retrieve so many, or the quality was really bad. It's this cycle that you're constantly going through of like ups and downs, highs and lows. So you have to temper your hope so that the despair doesn't get too high. I think I'm pretty sure it's like the medical, this is what they say, they call it cautiously optimistic, right? That you're being optimistic and you're being hopeful, but you're also not like buying the crib, getting all the baby clothes, buying diapers. You're hopeful and you're keeping the faith that it could work, but you're not setting up the baby room, you know? I mean, it's okay to hope and it's okay to cry, right? It's okay to be devastated if it doesn't work, but you have to pick yourself up and plan B, keep going, keep moving. loss, right? This isn't how it was supposed to be. I was supposed to be married at 20, and I was supposed to have my first kid at 20. And I was supposed to, you know, right? And I was supposed to have 5 kids by now. All my friends do, and I don't. I'm either still single, or I don't have any kids, or I only have 1, or I only have 2, and I wanted 7. Whatever it is, there's that sense of loss. We had a whole plan for ourselves. Either we were naive, or whatever it was, and it didn't work out the way that we wanted. And that's very difficult for people to take it to grasp, you know, that they had something set out for themselves and it didn't work out the way they wanted. And we all know how difficult that is when things don't pan out the way we want. And then ambivalence. Is it even worth it? Why am I doing this? It never works. I only feel bad about myself. My marriage is in shambles. I can't, like, look at my husband anymore because this is just all we think about. This is all we do is think about having a child. It's okay to go from wanting, I want to be in treatment, I want to try again, to not wanting, to saying, you know what, I'm okay with my life. We don't have kids, let's go travel. We don't have, you know, I'm not married yet, I'm going to go travel with my friends, and I'm going to do what I want and enjoy, and then hopefully that person will come along and things will be okay. But again, remembering that age is a factor in thinking about egg freezing if you are getting older. And there's, again, I said shame earlier, but shame, again, a feeling like maybe you're not feminine, right? Because that's what we're here for. We're here to have children. We are born with certain reproductive organs and things inside of us that is what we're supposed to do. So when our bodies fail us, we feel like we fail, even though it's something that is so completely not within our control. So I do want to close with just saying that all infertility is painful. There's primary infertility, which is you have no children. There's secondary infertility, which means you have a child or two even, or 3, and you, for whatever reason, can't have more. There's recurrent miscarriages, so people who either can't keep a pregnancy at all or have had pregnancies before and then just continue the miscarriage. So all infertility is painful. There's no suffering Olympics, right? Like, your suffering is more than mine. It's not a pain is pain, right? And we should never minimize someone else's pain and say, well, she has 3 kids, what is she complaining about? But again, it goes back to that loss. Like, she wanted a bigger family. She wanted more. Either she came from 6 and she wanted 6, or she came from only 1 and she wanted a big family. We never know, like, what is going on in someone's heart and someone else's pain, and we can't minimize that, and we can't take away from that. And then the last thing, actually, I just want to talk about is coping, right? So having all this, all these terrible, sad, awful things that come with infertility and fertility treatments, how do we even deal with this struggle and with the treatment? So the first thing is acknowledge your feelings, right? I'm a therapist, I have to say that, but acknowledge your feelings. I feel terrible, I feel devastated, I feel like it's never going to work, I feel horrible, I never want to see anyone again. It's okay to feel that way. Seek support. So there's organizations like PUA, ATIME, Boni Olam. All these organizations offer different things. They offer financial support for treatments. They offer support groups through phone groups so that you don't necessarily have to go in person and show your face. You know, it's private. Relax. Do things that you enjoy. Exercise, yoga, acupuncture, whatever it is that makes you feel calm and in a good place, do that. Talk to your partner. Right? But remember that men and women cope very differently. And I can't tell you how many clients have had that come to me, and they're like, my husband doesn't care. Every month I'm bawling and devastated, and he's like, okay, and turns over. But you have to understand that, like, men and women handle stress very differently. A woman could be crying for 5 days, and she's totally upset, but that's just not the man's way of doing it. It could also be the reverse. Sometimes women are like, okay, plan B, and the man is like, oh my gosh, like, this didn't work, what are we going to do? So remember that everybody copes differently, and you need to communicate with your partner what you would like from them. You know, he's not a mind reader, she's not a mind reader. Tell them, when it doesn't work, can you be sad with me for 5 minutes instead of being like, oh well, talk to me, hear me, tell me that you feel bad too. Right? And then you could be Mr. Fix-It or whatever it is. Learn as much as you can. And this is the most important part of fertility treatments. I can't tell you how many clients I have had that don't know what they're doing. They'll come to an office like RMA, where Dr. Klein works, and they have no idea what they're signing up for. You need to be your own best advocate, because as knowledgeable as the doctors are, and as much as they'll help you, they're not there 24/7 to explain everything to you and talk to you about all your options, and they can give you your options, but at the same time, you should go in knowing what you're getting yourself into. Advocate for yourself, research, find out statistics, whatever it is. Not too much knowledge, because too much knowledge can be harmful and can make you paranoid and whatever, but be an educated consumer. Know what you're doing when you go to these doctors, and don't let it consume you. I always say, give yourself like 20 minutes a day. I get to talk about infertility, and when those 20 minutes are up, I cannot talk about it anymore. I have to do something else. I have to focus on the positive. I have to focus on my husband, the kids that I have, or my family, or my job, or something good that distracts me. But it cannot be that 24 hours a day, all you're doing is looking at blogs and researching infertility and talking to your friends and being miserable. It doesn't help you, and it only makes you more insane. So that is that. So if anyone has any questions.
I want to thank our three presenters for so candidly and thoroughly addressing these very sensitive issues, and I'd now like to open it up for questions.
Thank you so much for coming to speak. Rob Willard, you made a separation between women that were married and women that weren't married. In the case of let's say a young couple that is engaged at an early age, and they are employed by one of these companies that's offered to put up the cost. Is it advisable to then freeze eggs at that optimal age, or because they're about to be married, to defer on that decision?
Exactly sure what the question is. Let me see the answer. You'll tell me if I answered your question. The couple's engaged and they're both working at Apple or Facebook, wherever they are, and they're ready to get married. They should get married and have their children naturally, and she should get off the Apple or Google fast track, which wants them to work till 35 at least, and they're willing to pay for their eggs to get 15 good years of employment. Where we come from, having children is more important than being on that fast track. So therefore, even though the option exists, she could work 15 years for Apple and then have those eggs that they paid for and try to have them defrosted, thawed, and fertilized, I don't advocate that at all.
So if I can just...
Please.
If freezing the eggs earlier on as a preemptive measure, so still going into the marriage with the expectation of having kids earlier on, but then having, if that is unsuccessful, then having the backup plan, having more.
As a rule, if the egg that you, the doctor, tell me if I'm wrong. As a rule, if the egg that you freeze at age 21 is going to work 15 years later, it'll work now too, in a natural sense. So there's no, it's not, your chances aren't improved by freezing your eggs and having done in the lab. That's the best of my knowledge.
I mean, I guess my follow-up commentary would be, because I guess you could take the question and sort of bring it ad infinitum or ad absurdum, that if you want to say, well, I want to have 10 children, and if I'm getting married, I'm 30, so for the next 5 to 10 years, I'm good, but then I'll be up to number 8, I'll be 43, it's going to be difficult, so I should freeze the eggs now. It's hard to argue with that argument, because it's true, if you freeze your eggs when you're 30, that's going to probably... If you're looking to get pregnant when you're 43, that's probably a nice thing to have in your back pocket. But I guess the other sort of point to make explicit is that generally, in the absence of, let's say, chemotherapy or some acute insult to reproductive potential, if you're talking about a short term, so, freezing your eggs now versus having having children in a year and a half after the wedding and so forth, short duration of time is rarely a meaningful impact. You're talking over the course of, if it's an open-ended situation, a woman who's, in her 30s and, she's hoping to meet someone tomorrow, but it could be in, 5 years from now. So that's much more compelling, I think, circumstance than if you're saying, well, I might, might not have kids for a year and a half. I think even biologically it's very difficult to argue that that's really a very significant, at some point it's not worth it if the time frame is so short.
Yes, that was a question for the doctor. You mentioned something about how in their late 20s you found statistically, generally, that eggs are healthier and more viable than in their early 20s. So if a person was shopping for an egg donor, would it be better if that person was between, let's say, 28 to 34? Or, you know, they were looking at an egg donor bank, let's say, for IVF.
Yeah, a little different question, I think, than what we're talking about in general, but I think it's probably fair to say that the very young 20s, 20, I mean,
under 25.
Yeah, under 25 is a little iffy, but after 20, you know, mid-20s and older.
So a donor from, like, 25 to 32 would be the ideal.
Optimal, right.
And do you as a doctor, have, like, lists of egg donors or
characteristics
or medical histories or whatever?
There's such a thing exists. Me, personally, probably wrote nothing. But, yeah, not
but
really.
But would a person get that?
There's, again, this is, I think, different than most of what we're focusing on, but there are most fertility clinics sort of maintain their own egg donor program. There are egg donor agencies that are basically businesses as brokers to make shidduch. It's not the kind of shidduch we're looking for. And then there's actually, these days, because eggs can be frozen, there are actually now egg banks that are
Google. And they're all equally medically sound.
Arguably. We can talk more about it.
Okay, thank you.
Other
I have a two-part question for Dr. Klein and Dr. Romoli. It's kind of like a follow-up thing of the situation. So when you say quality of egg, can you define that a little bit more? Because there are a lot of, unfortunately, like things that come up within embryology, right, that and development, that because science moves so fast, you know, 20 years ago, Down syndrome might have been something they couldn't prevent, but now it is. So what if someone wants to freeze their eggs in order to prevent those things in 10 years?
So it's a good question. So first of all, I'm a bit of a reductionist when it comes to biology because I think there's a lot of mystique around egg quality. I think the best way to define what egg quality means is that eggs are either normal or abnormal. It's not a spectrum of pretty good or not so good or so good. Any individual egg is either genetically intact or it's not. And the idea when we talk about egg quality and age is that as a group of the population of eggs, the percentage of eggs that are normal decreases as you get older. But even a 45-year-old woman who generally has poor egg quality, she'll have probably some normal eggs, which are perfectly normal. It's just that they may be only representing 1% of the eggs in her ovaries, let's say. So egg quality, to the best of the science that we know as of 2014, is really just a matter of does the egg have the correct number of chromosomes? That's actually what it refers to. So Down syndrome is the most famous example of a genetic defect with the wrong number of chromosomes. The reason why it's famous is because Down syndrome is the most mild clinically of this category of problems. So it's the only one where on a routine basis we have human beings that are born and, you know, sort of live a life in the world with a chromosomal defect in terms of having the wrong number of chromosomes. But built into a lot of what I sort of referenced earlier is that why does it get harder to get pregnant is because many months, if not most months, for women in their late 30s and certainly in their 40s, the egg is not genetically intact. Those eggs tend not to fertilize, or if they do fertilize, they don't implant, or if they do implant, they don't sort of develop past one or, you know, some short period of time. So it's really, again, a binary issue of normal or abnormal, not so much like this amorphous, how top quality are the eggs, so to speak. And then, and I don't know if I'm really answering completely your question, but the idea that, again, you can make the argument, well, once we're sort of taking egg freezing and going with it, well, maybe any couple who's married when they're 30 years old should say, well, if we want to have a big family, and, you know, so why should we run the risk of Down syndrome when we're in our late 30s? We should take our eggs now and freeze them, and so the risk of Down syndrome is much reduced than it is for those eggs. So everybody should be doing this. And the answer is, well, I guess probably like people I work for would like that because that would be good for business, but it probably is not the most reasonable proposal because at some level it's true. Younger eggs are more likely to be normal, healthy than older eggs, but again, it comes a point where you have to just start to, in a more realistic way, you know, think to what extent are you going to proactively invest resources, not just money, but, you know, all the other things that go into it and risk and so forth of the procedure for this theoretical risk reduction for later in life. That sort of thing to
suggest. Yeah, it kind of does. I mean, like everyone, I think, knows, you know, can't pass through like a million different you know, Baruch Hashem, I present a healthy child, it's awesome, but unfortunately, we don't. So,
most of those things, though, are, I mean, Down syndrome is, but a lot of
conditions
are right, not age-related genetic issues.
There are other things, and there's that, I know I'm going to say the word, and everyone's going to, like, shoot me a look, but there's abortion, right? So, like, if someone has a test while they're pregnant, they find the child isn't healthy, but they could have froze their eggs and gone route A instead of route B, which one?
So, it's true. I think what you're saying is, in theory, hard to argue with. It's, but like, a lot of things, like, bringing the theory down to sort of, so once again, like, so at what age, and then under what circumstances, if you have already three kids and you're 33 years old, is that... You know, should you be thinking about freezing your eggs, or if you're 36 and you have three and you want six, or, you know, but you're right. I mean, at some level, there's a direct correlation between the likelihood of having a problem, whether it's not getting pregnant or having miscarriages or having genetically abnormal pregnancies that don't miscarry, and at age. It's just a matter of, you know, this is a sort of a big deal in terms of the effort, the resources, again, not just money, but the effort and invasiveness and so forth that goes into it, that it's not something that, you know, if it was aspirin, that we could do the same thing, then maybe we should give everybody aspirin. But in this case, it's just from a practical perspective, not, you know, the relative risk-benefit ratio is weighted in both directions.
Okay. Time for one or two more questions, Steve.
If women freeze their eggs and don't end up using them, is it advisable if they have not donate them to other women?
So that's a good question. I guess the question is from what angle you're looking at it. Rovili can answer, obviously, from the important angle. But the short answer is it's complicated because there's a lot of, in the United States, there's a lot of regulatory stuff that goes into it. Infectious disease screening for those eggs. So it's not a common thing that happens. Plus, egg freezing is so new that most women who've frozen their eggs have done in the last 5 years, so not too many of them are already kind of in a position that they're ready to give them away. So realistically, it's actually not a question that's come up a lot in the world yet. But
just follow up, well, like if you do freeze and don't end up using them, are there any collecting implications for wasting them?
In my opinion, not only is it no halachic question of disposing of eggs, which are not going to be used by the person who donated those eggs, if you will. I believe that's even true, which is a bit more radical, of embryos, frozen embryos. The IVF process, they're often the embryos which are not going to be used. Some rabbis feel that once there is an embryo which has been frozen, you're not allowed to dispose of that embryo. And my view is it's permissible on the grounds that it's not an abortion. Abortion means there's a viable pregnancy, you are terminating it. Here, you have something in a lab, in a freezer. At that stage, it's not viable at all. And therefore, I believe even that would be permissible. That leads to another question, which is, if a person has frozen embryos, and they use one, and they succeed in having a child, and they have three others they don't plan to use, I say it's permissible to dispose of. Obviously, it's permissible for them to use. But can they donate that embryo? That's a new vista. This again, the science not that old. Frozen embryos, how many years before frozen eggs?
In the 1980s.
Yeah, so it's 20 years.
30 years
head start. And there are those who've done. There are couples who want to adopt a baby. Can't get one. It's a Jewish baby. Want to adopt a Jewish baby. You know, it's very hard. Especially since there's so much contraception and abortion is legal. Where are you going to find a Jewish baby these days? So they're desperate to get a Jewish baby. Meanwhile, this couple was blessed with an IVF success, and they don't want to have any more children, and the apple is lying around. Hey, why don't they just make a shidduch? Again, not the kind of shidduch that I'm looking for originally, but still, if they ask me, halakhically, the answer is yes, but of course, the donor should think long and hard before actually going through with it. So what you're doing is, in effect, some child of yours, your biological child of yours that's floating somewhere, they're all halakhish, brothers and sisters, and they can be overcome various ways. But something which is becoming now a point of discussion. But halakhically, if you have the question, can an egg be disposed of? I'm saying more than that. In my opinion, even an embryo can be disposed of.
I know this topic was primarily about freezing eggs, but I did want to just ask about this question of sperm and its viability, because it seems, at least in the media, and also it seems like in more scientific publications, there is more and more information coming out saying that older sperm is related to various developmental issues in children, etc. I don't know, I just wanted to ask, are you tracking this information? Has it influenced your discussions with any men who are older about this question, or were, you know, in a position possibly to freeze sperm? Is there a halakhic issue that you are discussing and considering with regard to men getting older and their quality of their sperm?
So from the medical and biological point of view, point number one I would say is that from a how capable a man is of having a child, how robustly fertile he needs to be, we tend to see mostly a plateau in a man's 20s, 30s, 40s, meaning pretty stable. And then many studies document that late 40s is a time when even men, on average, you're going to see a significant decline. Not a precipitous drop, but a significant decline in sperm counts and the quality of the sperm and the capability of having a pregnancy. That may or may not be related to a man's general health, meaning a lot of men, when they get to their 50s, are, you know, overweight or have blood pressure problems. And so those things are obviously going to be, and maybe they're just the mechanism through which this effect happens. But so you could argue, what about a very, you know, marathon runner, 55-year-old, is he less fertile? And the answer is, I don't know, it probably depends on the individual, but I think the science isn't as clear. But that's one aspect. And the second aspect, which you're alluding to, is the potential health of the children. And I'd say that's actually, if anything, even a more compelling subject. It's a kind of a bigger subject, but the short answer is there's actually really convincing data that exists that as a man ages, even starting in his 20s, relative to his 30s, relative to his 40s, the one thing that comes up a lot is the potential for autism or other autism spectrum disorders. And that data is actually pretty strong. That it's not, again, a dramatic or precipitous increase in the risk, but it's a small but meaningful increase in the risk of decades, not year by year, but decade by decade. Now, from a practical perspective, we have men coming in who are, you know, 35 asking to freeze their sperm almost ever. Maybe that's, you know, just because men either don't know or don't, you know, sort of want to think about it. But it's a real question, and I think that it's something that's being understood more slowly. So, and I don't know if Robo wants to comment on the halakhic side of things, but.
As I said before, if someone's going to be having cancer treatments, I believe very, very strongly in the freezing sperm, very strongly. Although again, I should add, it's not really halakhic imperative. As I said before, it goes both ways. The halakhic imperative of having children is just marrying and having a normal relationship with the wife. But even though it's not halakhically imperative, it's certainly, I believe, halakhically positive and encouraged to prevent male infertility. Beyond that, again, I'm not privy to all the stats that Dr. Klein has referred to, but if these studies project is minimal in nature, I would not be recommending freezing sperm so that, well, if the man is 30, is just X percent of the autism or something like that, and then when he's 40, it increases a tiny bit, I would not be running to freeze from just that. As I said earlier, I don't think we're running to freeze eggs, even though there's a slight increase in the number of Down's pregnancies as the woman gets a little bit older.
One last question.
I'm wondering if a woman who's not yet married decides to freeze her egg, if there are any halakhic restrictions. You know, a woman's undergoing IVF, so she may, retrieval time might be on Shabbos or Yom Tov, depending on when you know, blood levels are appropriate. So I'm wondering if there are any restrictions or if the same doulas are available for a woman who's not yet married.
That's an excellent question. One has to really, analyze what's the basis for the leniency for a married woman to have things done on Shabbos
even though there may be some otherwise halakhic prohibited activity. I'll give you my theory. My theory is it's based on a comment that many of the early commentators, just Tosfos, have with respect to when do we allow, because these things are generally done by non-Jewish practitioners, when do we allow the violation of Shabbat by non-Jews? As a rule, we assume it's prohibited if there's Torah violations. However, there's one exception according to most authorities, which is a mitzvah rabba, a great mitzvah. That's quite a term. We're not supposed to evaluate mitzvahs. So what's a mitzvah rabba? So the mitzvah rabba found in the Gemara, according to this understanding, is acquiring land in Eretz Yisrael. The letter tells a non-Jew, it's explicit in the Talmud, to write up a document in order to acquire land in Eretz Yisrael, which the Keren Kayemet did in the Rav Kook's decisions in the 20s, to buy up land. Mitzvah rabba. And the question is, why is that a mitzvah rabba? Every mitzvah is important. My theory is, it's a mitzvah which endures. If somebody, you know, many of us just ate a sandwich and made a birchas havoda. Very important mitzvah. A chal for the savot, that's a big mitzvah. But it's done, it's done. Finished. Eat matzah. Whoa, important. You finish, it's finished. Well, then in Eretz Yisrael, it's not finished. It lasts forever. And that's why, in my view, the mitzvah of having children is a mitzvah rabba. If one is successful in doing so, the result of the mitzvah is forever. And therefore, in my view, that is the definition of this leniency. Would it apply to a single woman? In my view, since she had every hope and expectation of marrying, then it would apply to her as well.
I want to thank our presenters for their inspiring and very good words. I know that they'll be happy to stay around for a few moments to take further questions up at the front of the room, and I wish everyone a good evening.